Today on Face the Nation, bad just got worse. Now what?
Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer.
Welcome back to our continuing series, Politics and the Press. I'm Jerry Pippin, and we have Mike Miller with us, who's had a great career, a long career, not only in the media as a TV anchor, TV news reporter in Washington, D.C., but also he worked for several people in Washington as a press secretary, a couple of congressmen, and one senator. And you worked with Bob Cheever.
Absolutely.
That was at Metromedia, and they had quite a good reputation.
They were the most successful independent station in the country in 69 when I went up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to work the same day as Bob Cheever. He and I both were hired the same day at WTTG, Channel 5, the Metromedia station. And Cheever told me that day, he says, I'm not going to be here very long. My plan is to go to CBS News as soon as I can get there. And I'd say within 6 months or 8 months, Eisenhower died, and he was anchoring the coverage. Uh-huh. CBS saw him, and that really helped him apply for the job and got it. About the time Bob Gregory, the guy who had hired me a couple of times in Tulsa, was leaving CBS News, so there was an opening there. And Cheever was there. Connie Chung was hired. She got her first job. Walked into the newsroom. She had just graduated from college. You could imagine how she looked, about 19 years old. And the news director, Mike Buchanan, looked at her and he said, "I don't know who you are or what you can do, but you're hired." And Maury Povich, the guy she's married to, was a sports director there at the time.
Oh, really? A sports guy? I didn't know that. I thought I was thinking current affair was his first job.
He was probably married to someone else, and I think Connie eventually ended up in Los Angeles.
Yes, she did.
Co-anchoring the news with Maury Povich, and I think that's when
the things happened, right?
Yeah, began. But I ran into Connie. She's something else. She is unpretentious, and she would. I always got Christmas cards from her for years, and I ran into her at a convention, Republican convention, in Dallas, I think it was, and I was like a long lost friend, big hug, and I still get a card every Christmas season from Connie and Maury. It's not a Christmas card, it's a season. I think Maury's Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And so the card is not Christmassy, but it's, she never forgets. And I always get a card from her. She's just a very nice person. And it never went through her head. And Maury was a little bit look down your nose at other people. He was not only the sports director. You know, his father was a sports editor of the Washington Post, Shirley Povich, and he was pretty high and mighty. He had a show called a noon type show for 2 hours. Where he and two other people just Panorama, it was called.
That's right. It was used by Metromedia stations everywhere, all across the country. That title, that format.
Yes. And so he might have had some complexes, but inferiority wasn't one of them. Put it that way.
Well, that doesn't surprise me.
No, he was nice to me. You know.
Now, at Metromedia in Washington, D.C., I mean, what was your beat? What did
you
cover?
I covered the Capitol and the White House.
Oh, so you were already into politics. Now, you had this job before you got your first press secretary job, is that right?
Yep. Right. Yeah. the press secretary jobs all came about 10 years later when I came back to Washington with Bethune. But all this experience covering politics was very helpful as a press secretary, where you had to deal with the press because you could see their side of everything and you understood their problems. Because a press secretary, you work for the congressman or senator, but you also, you have to, you work for the media too, in a way, because you have to service them. You have to provide them with the information they're seeking and what help them do.
As long as we're talking about the press secretary job, I still puzzle at why Senator Inhofe, at that time Congressman Inhofe, would let you go. I mean, after all, you have been the anchor on all three television stations in Tulsa, his hometown. He was a U.S. Senator from Oklahoma. You would think you'd put up with a lot just to have somebody of high profile like you were by reputation as the press secretary. I mean, that's just, that's not very smart.
Well, it was just a personality clash, I think. It happens.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, like in Bethune's office, I got along fine with the member, Ed Bethune. It was just his administrative assistant that wanted to go over everything I did with a red pen and mark it all up, and you'd have to type it all over again. You didn't have a computer.
Yeah.
You just had a Selectric, IBM Selectric, and some whiteout.
I think that's kind of the personality of a chief of staff anyway, that they want to micromanage everything, even when the candidate goes to the bathroom.
Yeah, sometimes you have clashes with the chief of staff, the administrative assistant, whatever they call them. There are two types of offices on Capitol Hill, we found. There's the slave shop and the fun shop. And in the fun shop, you know, usually Friday afternoons, they break out the beer and the booze, and you party a lot, and things are relaxed. You certainly get every holiday off, and you work your 8 hours and leave. Then there's a sweatshop, which Bethune's office turned out to be, and thanks to the administrative assistant. And we worked every holiday. We were there Christmas Day, whatever. And
Mike, you just blew the image. Most people, if you asked them, would think that politicians and their staffs don't have to work very hard. It's really not true.
Oh, no. People really, even in the fun offices, you worked hard. You worked your 8 hours, and you worked hard. It was easier on the Senate side because the staffs are bigger. You have more, the work is divided among more people. And for the most part, I had an assistant when I worked for Senator Hecht, and that was helpful. But, you know.
And, of course, since the senator was from Nevada, you got to go to Las Vegas a lot.
Oh, yeah, that was a big perk. Yeah, a party there.
You were there the whole 6 years.
Yep, and I remember the campaign. People, the media totally ignored him. They didn't do even one, the local media didn't do one single interview with him. Or cover him at all. It's hard to believe, I know, but it's true. And they just didn't think he had a chance, and I guess they just wrote him off. And then when he won, he kind of made fools out of them, and they were very they just either ridiculed him or ignored him after he became senator.
Unfortunately, that's an aspect of media and journalism, really. We're not very proud of it.
Yeah, you get your personal feelings involved.
Mm-hmm.
I remember after he was elected, I went by all the media. I always made a habit of going by and introducing myself and offering, you know, whatever we can do to help. And we have the Library of Congress at your disposal if you need to research something, blah, blah, blah. And at the Las Vegas Sun, their editor, he said immediately off the bat, he said, Why did Chick Heck hide out during the campaign? Nobody could find him. And then there were several of his staff in there. newspaper staff in there, and they said, well, you know, we did an interview with him, but we didn't run it. And the editor really apologized. He said, you know, maybe it is our fault. And so things can kind of get out of hand. And images that are not really accurate.
Yeah, that happens in life.
It prevails.
Sometimes it's not very fair.
yeah, absolutely.
I've had image problems off and on. And we know I'm a nice guy.
Yeah, right.
Let's get back to Jim Inhofe and his limited thinking. Is that prevalent in your days in Washington, D.C.? Did you, frankly, run across a lot of airheads?
There were a few. I'd say a very small minority. Most of them ended up in scandals. I know there was one member of Congress who had sex on the Capitol steps with his wife, so it was okay, I guess. But it was at night, and he got caught. And that, you know, things like that don't look real good for your reelection chances. Judgment, you know, poor judgment. And then, of course, Wilbur Mills, you know, Bethune replaced Wilbur Mills in Arkansas, and I don't know if you remember how his career ended.
Yes, I do.
He was
in some sort of fountain or something.
The tidal basin.
Yeah.
he was cavorting with
a dancer?
A stripper.
Mm-hmm.
And Fanny Fox, I believe her name was.
Yes, you're right.
He came to our reception after Ed was sworn in, and I was talking to him, and I said, do you have any advice to a fledgling press secretary who's never had this job before? And he said, well, I never had a press secretary. Well, I said, don't tell Ed.
Was he bitter?
He didn't seem to be. He apparently had stopped drinking. He was drinking, I believe he said, a quart of whiskey a day. While he was chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, tax writing,
yes,
body, and the story was that he was drunk when all this tax legislation was written, and now, you know, people trying to do their taxes are driven to drink. You know.
That's a good line, Mike. You're full of them today. I'm impressed.
Well, the book is full of them.
Okay, let's talk about the book. It's still available on Amazon, and it's called How High Can I Stoop? It's a great read, 16 or 17 chapters, if I remember.
Oh, yeah. It's the thing about it is there's 17 chapters. The thing about the book, I'm not promoting any kind of conservative philosophy. I'm not trying to convert liberals to be conservative. Just because I worked for three conservatives and the National Republican Senatorial Committee doesn't influence the way I wrote the book. I was primarily just trying to show the inner workings of working for a member of Congress, how their offices operated, and the funny things that happened. That was the emphasis, was on humor. And I tried to just compile every funny thing that ever happened to me, and there were quite a few.
Well, you not only talk about things in politics that are funny, but you some interesting things in the media. For instance, in Tulsa, you mentioned the TV anchor who was part of an X-rated film. I remember that part, even though I read the book several years ago.
That's right.
And you wouldn't tell me who it was.
Well... I didn't want to get sued, and I still don't want to get sued. However, back in those days, you had, you know, when we were still processing film.
Yeah, right.
Of course, it'd be easier, I guess, with videotape. But at the time, if you had access to a camera, a film camera and a processor, all you needed was a female or two, and you had yourself an X-rated movie. And this was done at one of the stations I worked with, and it was a couple of prostitutes that we hired to come perform for us, and there we pulled out the film cameras and they were filmed, and I'll be damned if about a couple of weeks later I get a call from the police chief, Jack Purdy, his secretary. Mike, Jack, I'd like to talk to you if you don't mind coming over. So I went over there, talked to Chief Purdy, and he and his top captain closed the door and they said, started quizzing me about this X-rated film. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do here? And Purdy said, I don't care anything about the film. I just want to know if there was a prostitute or two that had been murdered, and he wanted to know if it was the same, if they had appeared in this movie, and I knew they had not and told him so. And because we had been doing some stories that were rather critical of the police commissioner at the time, the police department was divided, and some of them were siding with Chief Purdy and some were siding with the police commissioner. And he told me frankly, he said, look, there's people in the vice squad that would like to, they know about your film, and he said, I would destroy it if I were you. And so I was very apprehensive at that moment about it, and found it and tried to burn it, and it wouldn't burn. But I found a jigsaw back in the area where they made sets and stuff. And cut it up into about a million pieces, put it in a brown paper bag, and threw it off the Arkansas River Bridge. And it's hopefully resting among the fishes.
Yeah, I think I saw it float right by me here in Muskogee.
Could have. It would have some faces on it that everyone would recognize their name. Actually, the girl that was one of the prostitutes that was in the movie was a key witness in a big murder trial that I was covering. Oh, must have been 6 months, 7 months later. And she was on the witness stand, and the defense lawyer turned to her and said, out of the clear blue, did you ever make a pornographic movie? And I thought to myself, she's going to stand up and point to me and say, why don't you ask him? He was there. And I thought, oh, the beads of sweat are breaking out, you know. And fortunately, she just committed perjury, and she said no. And I...
Do you think that lawyer knew something, Mike?
In
other words, it was all over town.
Yeah, it was getting there. But, you know, in those days, people did very risky things that they probably don't do today nearly as much. I remember there was a district judge that, during a murder trial, he called me back to his chambers and during a recess, and he said, Mike, I want to show you something. And he pulled out this big, blown-up picture of a nude woman, and she had signed it, thank you, Judge so-and-so, for getting my divorce. And he thought that was funny. You know, stuff like that gets around. It could be the end of a judicial career. And today, and back in there, in those days, you know, 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
You know, Mike, contrary to conventional wisdom, I think it's much more conservative or puritanical today than it was back then. Back then, almost anything went and did.
I think so. You know, in those days, drinking...
almost everybody was drunk.
Everybody was drunk. I worked for one guy. He took me every day out to lunch, and we'd have a tall beer on the way to a restaurant and have three drinks at the restaurant and another beer on the way back to the station, and then I had to produce a newscast. And
yeah.
You kind of got used to all that, but then some of the photographers were growing marijuana plants right outside the station side entrance, and it was just risky behavior all the way. You remember Gary Busey?
Yes, the actor.
Yeah, and the Mazeppa, Gillard Sartain.
Yeah.
They were working at Channel 8.
Yeah, they hosted a late night movie series, and it was hilarious.
I was doing the news right before their show came on.
And that was a very, very well watched show.
Yeah, it was. And
they were stoned, huh?
Well, I think Busey was. I think Gaylord, he was more, he liked alcohol better than drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But they would gather, the marijuana smokers would gather in the stock room, storage room, and smoke in there. And then one night there was a fundraising thing going on in the big studio next door. And all the smoke drifted in through the air conditioning system. And things were very kind of shaky.
Yeah, that's the old Channel 8 when Jimmy Lake had it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He was quite a guy. You know, he used to come by on the radio on my show at KBIX every night. When we did kind of a variety program, a little talk, a little oldies, a lot of things, a lot of memories. I think he really enjoyed coming by. Of course, I was never accessible to him when it could have done me some good, I guess. But I enjoyed having him come by and tell those stories.
Yeah, he's a great guy.
Yeah.
I remember we did a show. He and I were guests.
Yes, that's right.
On one of your shows right before he died.
Right. And he
well, he actually was a pretty good operator. Low budget, but compared to the places I was working, he was a he was up there. I mean, if you worked for him, you got paid.
Well, I think some of that money went into his cars, his antique car collection. And he had probably one of the best.
Yes, he did.
And he had a big show once. One Saturday.
Yeah, a car show.
Big car show at the Exposition Center out at the fairgrounds.
Yes.
And, of course, Channel 8. It was a Saturday, and, of course, we covered it like gangbusters, and we were going to close the newscast with about a five-minute piece on it. And we went into the... I was anchoring, and I went into the break right before that... I promoted it. When we come back, Jimmy Lake's Antique Car Show. And... during this commercial break, the director or the film projectionist said, "I don't have that film. I don't have that piece of film." You talk about panic. I didn't have time to run and look for it
because I'm
stuck in the studio. So I had to apologize and say, "Due to technical problems, we don't have it." And Lake had retired to his house with a bunch of his friends to watch the coverage on his own station, which wasn't there. He wasn't real happy. I didn't want to bring that up. Would have probably hurried up his demise, but I think he did. A couple of people were fired over that episode. Fortunately, I wasn't one of them, but it was a horrible feeling to know that this is Jimmy Lake's story and his own station can't even get it on air.
Mike, if the audience enjoys these old war stories as much as I do, we've got a hell of a show going here.
When I the first job in TV was at Channel 2, and it was the third rated station, and there were reasons for that. They couldn't do anything right. It was just a comedy of errors, and they would play music underneath silent film stories.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that everybody had stopped doing years ago, but they were still doing it. And I remember we had a story about, and I was anchoring then, and we had a story about the Easter pageant in Tulsa, West Tulsa. And we had the film of it. And as I went through there, I told the audio guy, I said, "We have an Easter feature on, so we need something appropriate." And I don't remember whether I said Easter pageant or not, but when we saw a film of Christ carrying the cross, we heard, "In your Easter bonnet with all the..."
Ooh.
That was not
good. Not in the heart of the Bible Belt.
Okay.
Especially down in Tulsa, the home of Oral Roberts University.
Oh. So, you know, there were a lot of bad things that would happen when you were anchoring. I remember one time the owner, Harold Stewart, stopped me in the hallway on my way to the studio, and it was like 1 minute of ten, and he's engaging me in some topic that was not of any importance, and I was basically late, and I heard the theme of the news start, and I rushed into the studio, and they had already gone to the set, an empty set, nobody sitting there. And I said, can you tell the director to go to black so I can come in and sit down? He said, I can't tell the director anything. So I had to come in and just sit down and excuse myself for being late. So anchoring is a whole different ball game from everything else because it's live TV and just about anything can happen.
And it usually does.
Yes, as you probably know, live radio.
Well, I've had some experience as a TV anchor at a very small station in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Now, I mean, we had lower budgets than you did in Tulsa by far. You guys were big time.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So we learned how to ad-lib pretty well. It was a matter of survival.
Yeah, I can imagine. You've got to learn that. Or you'll die out there.
Mike Miller, you mentioned Channel 2 in the snafus. Well, they have one popular show. We're listening to the theme, Fantastic Theater. It was on Saturday night, just like Mazeppa was, over on Channel 8. That wraps up this segment in our series, Politics in the Press, but we have much more coming up. Mike Miller is our guest. I'm Jerry Piffle.